Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat. Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Manoj Kewalramani, and today I have with me, in a house full of sorts, I've got Akshay Aladi, Pranay Kotasthane, and Anirudh Kaniseti, all three authors, along with Anupam Manur, of a new assessment that Takshashila has come out with, which looks at India in the post-COVID-19 world order. Now, we've been talking about sort of geopolitical changes following the pandemic, but this is a special document which looks at exactly what India should be doing, what kind of a world India faces, domestic reforms that are needed to be taken, how it will impinge on foreign policy, and much more. So without sort of further ado, Anirudh, I'm going to start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about how the world is likely to change? I mean, you're already seeing some signs of this, right? So we're already seeing tensions between the US and China. We're already seeing sort of some tensions between India and China also on the border. And lots of things are happening in terms of trade also. But so how do we think about what are these changes that are taking place?
All right. So this really draws on a lot of research that we've been doing since 2017, aiming to understand how the world order is going to change over the next quarter century. Now, when we were coming up with a bunch of possible scenarios to think of how the world was going to change, the way we were looking at it was to think that a world order is a result of the intersection of a certain kind of geoeconomic order and a certain kind of geopolitical order. Now, if you look at the world that we are in today, there's been a lot of talk about how COVID might very well mark a turning point in history. I don't really think it marks a turning point so much as an acceleration of existing geoeconomic and geopolitical trends that have already been in place for quite a while. One of which, of course, is the fact that China has been rising and that the US hasn't really had a clear strategy to deal with them. If you look at particularly the way that both these countries have responded to the COVID-19 pandemic, neither of them have really shown the kind of global leadership that the world has gotten used to expecting from superpowers over the last few decades, have they? This really draws on Henry Kissinger's idea that power in the international space, or really authority in the international space, lies at the intersection of two things, of power and legitimacy. Now, arguably, both the US and China are as powerful as they've always been. They still have, you know, the largest armies. They still have, you know, the most sophisticated navies, the most high-tech equipment. But at the same time, the way that they have responded to the outbreak, the way that, for example, the US has responded by basically trying to make it seem like it's all China's fault, by arm-twisting even friendly nations like India, by bungling its domestic response, by not really having a coherent strategy. If you look at the way that China's gone about responding to it in terms of providing aid to countries in return for compliments, trying to shut down criticism of its initial handling of the pandemic, and even its diplomats engaging in so-called wolf warrior diplomacy, you know, where they have this very combative kind of stance, and some of them have made outright false statements trying to insinuate that the US was the origin of the pandemic. What we're seeing is that I think a lot of countries, especially middle powers, are increasingly realizing that the superpowers aren't what they used to be. They aren't global leaders in the way they used to be. And in that sense, a lot of middle powers, especially if you think Germany, for example, or if you think Russia or India, are no longer going to look to, you know, the G2 to kind of solve their problems. We are going to see an age of increased assertiveness from the middle powers. We're going to see them trying to chart their own way. In our analysis, we think that the middle powers especially are going to form more kind of flexible multilateral groupings. We don't necessarily see them falling into either the American or the Chinese bloc. We also think that given the fact that the US now really seems to be understanding just what a threat China is in so many different dimensions, we suspect that there is going to be a more confrontational relationship between the two, new Cold War, you know, quote unquote, as it were, where you will see them competing in multiple domains, where you will see them trying to make sure that other countries are part of their economic systems, part of the political systems. And we're also going to see a lot of changes that happen in the global economy as a result of the pandemic. We are already seeing a recession in a lot of countries due to the fact that lockdowns have been imposed. It does not seem likely that all these countries are going to recover equally well. There's going to be a lot of restrictions on the flow of international labor, for example, because of the fears of the pandemic. Global capital is going to flow more and more towards only well-performing developing economies. And finally, I think the most important thing that this pandemic has brought out to every country in the world is the fact that it is really risky to have a single global manufacturer. It's extremely risky to have a lot of supply chains concentrated in China. And as a result, one thing that we suspect is that over the coming years, more and more companies are going to invest in kind of diversifying the supply chain, shortening the supply chains, building in redundancies. And in a lot of ways, the era of globalization, the era of untrammeled flow of capital, untrammeled flow of labor is really at an end. Going forward, it's much more likely that the tides of economic and populist nationalism are going to rise once again across the world. And we're going to see that supply chains, trade agreements, bilateral agreements between countries, strategic agreements are all increasingly driven by more hard-nosed calculations of national interest, as opposed to, you know, just stepping back and letting the superpowers take care of things.
All right, so that makes sense. I mean, you've captured all the different aspects of things, and this is what you've called in the document a race to the bottom, right? So where you're going to see far more nationalism, you're going to see far more problems economically, and you're going to see some degree of geopolitical jostling between the major powers, which is the US and China, and then also other powers, which are the middle powers, having a certain space for themselves. Okay, so how does, this sounds, in some ways, it sounds like it's good from an Indian point of view, because, you know, if middle powers will have greater bargaining space, it sort of benefits us. And also, if people want to shift out of China, the supply chains out of China, this is a conversation that's happening in India right now, that, you know, we'll be attracting so many companies from China. Again, that sounds like it's good from an Indian point of view. So is the view that this is all in some ways beneficial from an Indian point of view, or are there other challenges also that this poses?
Hi, Manoj. So it is sort of two ways to look at it. One thing that we write is, for India to take advantage of this particular situation, a lot of things need to be done on the domestic front. And if those domestic issues are resolved, things which we need to do, we divide into three phases: about first overcoming the pandemic itself, then reconstruction, and then moving towards a post-COVID-19 world. So there are steps that we need to do in order to first increase our own leverage in this particular world. So if we do that, then this world is probably something which India can take advantage of. If not, then India's relative power will actually decline, and it will have no other option but to ally with one of the two major powers at a particular point of time.
Okay, so you've divided these domestic reforms that you're talking about in three different phases, right? So there's phase one, which is till 2021, and then there's phase two of reconstruction, which is till 2024, and then subsequently phase three, which is thereafter from 2024 onwards. Can you sort of take us a little bit into what are these different phases and what sort of domestic reforms are we talking about? We're already seeing some conversation on labor reforms and so on and so forth in India. And these are some of these conversations which have existed for a very long period of time: labor, land, so on and so forth. What are the kind of things that India needs to do according to us?
So in terms of actually looking at all these three phases, the objective as well as the time frames for these three phases are quite distinct. First, as Pranay mentioned, there's a response to the pandemic. And there, in many ways, it's really about how to keep the economy on life support with an artificially induced coma, right? Which is what the economist Adam Tooze called it. Where really what you want is, you actually do want a short-term recession. But at the same time, you want to mitigate the effects of that on the poor, right? So for the large part, the focus will be transfer of money to the poor through direct benefit transfers, as well as keeping enterprises alive with the right kind of credit support and credit lines. This is just to tide over the immediate crisis so that at the end of it, I mean, you do have people, their own suffering being mitigated, as well as companies still being solvent to be able to go to the next phase. The phase after that is what we're calling reconstruction. And that is when the classic fiscal and monetary stimulus measures become viable, which is when the economy starts to open up. But because of stress in terms of a demand shortfall, which has to then be made up. There will have to be significant fiscal stimulus in the form of government spending, which will be a combination of both, again, income transfers largely directed towards the poor, but also like large-scale infrastructure building, which will create its own kind of demand source. And also a monetary stimulus, which is through a range of measures from credit guarantees to lower interest rates to easier access to capital to be able to fund the reconstruction. So that is kind of phase two, which will take at least like 3 years after that until 2024, which is the phase of reconstruction. The third phase really is about the objective of that is to make India an industrial power, right? The real opportunity that comes about in this post-COVID world, as Anirudh and Pranay both mentioned, is the shift of global supply chains, and at least a share of that India has an opportunity to capture. But to be able to do that, there has to be significant amount of domestic reform, because manufacturing in India has had like multiple challenges. Primarily, I mean, one could classify that into two or three broad areas. The first is really policy and regulatory stability itself, which is, can an investor put in money in India with kind of a stable outlook on law and regulation such that the investment is de-risked for the entire duration of the investment, which is for 7 years, right? And India has had several challenges ranging from things like retrospective taxation, regulatory burdens, frequent tax changes, and so on, which raises the risks for investors. The second set of areas is really around factor market reforms. And this is where some of the recent moves kind of are in that direction, which is really around labor, but also around land reforms, which will make it easier for people to access land. And then a lot of what we talked about in terms of the infrastructure building will also lower the cost of being able to produce and manufacture and then trade with the rest of the world. So that also becomes quite critical in terms of what needs to be done, right? So regulatory and judicial reform, which gives policy stability, and then really the factor market reforms coupled with infrastructure building, which also includes power. These will be some of the things that will be required in the to capture the opportunity to really become a manufacturing power over the longer run.
There's a lot that's also been written in the document about, you know, going forward into the future, looking at things like opportunities in the service sector,
yes,
looking at building India as a global, sort of follow a global in-house center approach where, you know, you become a center for, in-house center, you have facilities for global MNCs. Can you sort of talk a little bit about these? What are these approaches? What are we looking at?
So India actually, even in the last phase, was actually a fairly big beneficiary of globalization, right? The second biggest beneficiary of globalization actually after China. So in many ways, I mean, while we move towards this post-COVID world and there are these different economic webs, how can we still benefit from a more limited form of globalization that will still be there, right? And that will require India to undertake multiple moves. One is, of course, in terms of our own openness to trade, really transitioning towards a low import duty regime, which still means that we are integrated with some of these economic webs because supply chains will still not be purely in a single nation. So we are not envisaging global autarky here, where every nation kind of only produces for itself, but largely a kind of like a partial globalization or partial deglobalization. And to be able to participate in that, you still need a low import duty regime. The other is to actually come up with free trade agreements and free trade zones, both within the region with things like Bangladesh and so on, which are fairly large and could be significant in specific supply chains such as textiles and so on. But also like explore free trade agreements with others with whom we may have economic complementarities, right? And then the couple of other areas would be an in-house center approach, or what we're calling GSA 2.0, which is really to allow global MNCs to be able to set up in-house centers and follow an insourcing model here, right? So whether it, I mean, in the IT, even BPO sectors that work quite well, but also to be able to do that in manufacturing. If you create special zones where manufacturing companies can acquire land, build plants, and to be able to export, right, from there, and to be able to even have freer movement of labor, right, within such in-house centers as well as their global centers, then that could kind of propel our growth in a way that that it did even in the last phase of globalization. That time around, it was in the IT, BPO, and services sectors. Now it could even be replicated in the manufacturing. And then largely, I mean, the last area would really be to build on our core strengths, which is India has been in many ways the back office or the service provider to the rest of the world. With the new norms of social distancing, with technology playing an increasing role in terms of being able to work remotely and so on, opportunities or disruptions will really happen in multiple other sectors as well. So that could range from things like healthcare, where telemedicine could be significant, or on education, many other things such as business consulting, data processing, data analytics, even things like marketing. These are all things that can be delivered remotely using technology. And India, as someone which has a head start and which has like low-cost telecommunications in particular, can really tap into this opportunity of in the services.
All right. Okay. So a lot of what you suggested is about there's a geopolitical component to all this, depending on how the world shapes up, because you need to work with international partners. And before I get to that, my sort of last question on this reforms, and Pranay, if you could take this, is looking at where do we get the money for all these investments? We're talking about stimulus packages in the long term to sort of develop infrastructure. Where do we get the money for all of this, given that generally there's going to be an economic downturn? And we're already seeing that, right? People are losing jobs, companies are no longer functioning at the moment, and things are going to be difficult, even from a consumption point of view going forward. And from my understanding, India's sort of foreign exchange reserves are at about $450-470 billion. Where do we get the money to do this massive investment in infrastructure and all of these things?
Right. Some of the long-term measures which Akshay mentioned, they don't require any investment, right? In fact, they require us to let go of some of the restrictions that we've built for ourselves. For example, transitioning to low import duty regime and all, we'll lose some import duties, but that's not significant. So those things are more about policy reforms which don't require cost. But let's look at the short-term measures which do require investment into infrastructure, maybe we need a large-scale fiscal stimulus, etc. So for that, the answer is that government can always find the money if it wants to, really. Okay. The thing is that it is possible for governments to increase fiscal deficit norms for some short period of time. We'll have to really do a good job of limiting it and having sunset clauses, etc. But that is possible for governments to do. There is also the talk of RBI monetizing the deficit, or RBI reserves being used, not the foreign exchange reserves, but the RBI reserves which the government parks with it, those can be utilized. So there are options which a lot of macroeconomists have proposed, and it is possible for the government to use these emergency funds, limit them to this particular 2 or 3 years usage, and invest it in a way that can help us take advantage in the next 4 or 5 years. That is why invest it in infrastructure, invest it in things which have higher multiplier effects, and that is important.
All right. Okay. So like you have argued that, at the end of the day, if India sort of manages the economic fallout of all of this and actually emerges stronger in terms of its economic development, that sort of has an impact on how we function internationally in terms of the sort of geopolitical situation. And as Aniruddha sort of outlined, that this geopolitical situation that you see evolving, the world order that you see evolving, is one where both the superpowers, although diminished in their absolute sort of strength, are still competing quite vigorously, and the middle powers tend to have some space for bargaining, and the economy will play a role in that. So what are the kind of things that India should be doing apart from ensuring that the economy functions well and that sort of thing that develops well? What should we be doing in this sort of geopolitical environment? What are the challenges that this throws up for us, this geopolitical environment, and how do we navigate this better? Aniruddha, do you want to sort of take a stab at that to begin with?
Sure, Manoj. So I would say that there's actually a bunch of things that India needs to be doing irrespective of what the US and China are up to globally. The first big change, of course, is to rethink the way that we exert military power. Now, India has one of the largest armies in the world, but it has chronic issues in terms of the quality of its equipment, in terms of quality of acquisition, and so on and so forth. We should really be adopting a more long-term view. We need to be shifting towards new ways of projecting military power. We need to be shifting from manpower to firepower, from conventional to subconventional warfare, and really invest in new domains where conflict is happening already at a threshold short of war, especially cyberspace. I think that's one really big thing that India needs to be getting into, especially as Akshay mentioned, considering that we are going to be we would like to be the service provider of the world, it should not really be too hard to find human resources for that kind of transition. In addition to that, I briefly talked about in the beginning how a lot of countries are kind of seeing how multilateral institutions, international institutions led by the superpowers aren't necessarily meeting their interests anymore. And in our view, middle powers are going to be far more open to engaging in these multilateral institutions going forward, very issue-based groupings, if as it were. That's something that India definitely needs to be investing in doing. It helps establish our own credibility as a major power, and also helps ensure that there are a number of friendly nations working with us on varied issues that might be of the national interest. The third big thing that we think that India needs to be doing is to seriously understand that China is not going away. China is going to remain India's primary geopolitical challenge over both the medium and long terms. And that's something that we need to be investing in balancing right away. One potential way that India could be doing this is to kind of strengthen the quadrilateral grouping with Japan, Australia, and the US. Even now, there's a certain amount of reticence from all these countries in terms of actually making it into a security-based grouping. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that. I would think that when we were talking about domestic economic reforms, talking about infrastructure building, for example, I'm sure that Japan would be absolutely delighted to invest in building infrastructure in India because of the amount of potential that such investment could have. So we should be thinking about expanding the Quad into issues other than security as well. All these things we think would like really help increase India's weight as a pole on the geopolitical arena. But even after India does these things to kind of ensure its own security, ensure its own influence in the world, a lot depends on what the superpowers are doing. And we've provided a kind of algorithm or a pathway, as it were, for India to look at. We don't think that bandwagoning with China, becoming a Chinese ally, is realistic at all. That should really be confined to the realms of fantasy, especially given recent developments in the India-China relationship, given what we know of the behavior of the People's Republic towards India. We think that India's two major choices are really this. Either we can be a swing power that balances between China and the US on various issues of national and global importance, or we can be an outright US ally. Now, becoming a swing power, of course, really depends on how powerful India is on the global stage. If the economy is doing well, if we have a certain guarantee from China that China is not going to be infringing upon our territorial integrity and so on, then it kind of makes sense to play a more neutral role, as it were, on the international stage. But if that kind of promise is not forthcoming from China, or if India's economy is in such a state that it needs to pick either one of the superpowers to kind of integrate into its economic web, the US is the power that's more likely to be favorable to Indian interests. The US is more likely to be okay with India being the regional hegemon of the Indo-Pacific. So basically, if India's economy is not doing well, if China is not forthcoming in terms of making certain geopolitical assurances to India, then going with the US is the way to go.
All right. Akshay and Pranay, I want to get your thoughts on this. Okay, this idea of firstly being a swing power. So I had spoken about sort of, it's like you're swinging between the US and China. But what does essentially being a swing power entail? Because while getting into any one camp is going to be really difficult, China, for the various reasons that we know, historical, present territorial, and the strategic competition. But US also in the context of, credibility, reliability, and, just the sense of becoming a front line when you can avoid to become a front line and sort of deny yourself, say, potentially investments coming from China and so on and so forth. So how, firstly, just talk to me a little bit about how difficult this choice is and what would being a swing power entail?
So I think, for India, it gets quite complicated actually, because there is not necessarily a perfect convergence of interests with even the US, right? And this is across both the military and economic spheres. And as you also mentioned, there's also the factor of US reliability as an ally through this period, which is called under question. Because as a declining superpower, where the US chooses to exercise power and where they choose to recede, is not obvious at this stage, and hence reliance upon a declining superpower in any case is not something that may be prudent in all scenarios, right? So it is a tough choice for India. What it will take, I mean, I think Aniruddh has already outlined the parameters for us to consider, which is our relative power vis-a-vis both. What it would mean in terms of actual policy choices would actually be openness to trade and investment on the one hand. So where you're talking about constructing, let's say, free trade agreements and still participating in a partial globalization or partial deglobalization process, our ability to be able to actually construct free trade agreements with a US while still not shutting ourselves out from the Chinese market, right? Both ways, in terms of trade and in terms of investment and also capital flows. That actually will be quite a complex thing for India to navigate, right? The second really will be on technology, where it gets even more complex, because the in terms of intellectual property and technology and the ability to share that, there's it's far more likely that that will be an area of contestation between the US and China. So there we may actually have to make hard choices, and it depends a lot on what kinds of concessions or accommodations both these powers are willing to make. For us to be able to make a choice between one and the other, it's unlikely, I would say, that we'll be able to freely participate in both technology webs as we may be able to pull off in let's say, trade and investment, where it might be relatively easier, right? So that's, I think, something which where it might get more complex. Immigration is another area where I think it could be relatively easier to have some kind of participation in both economic webs. On the one hand, with the US in terms of some of the service flows that we talked about and insourcing of or rather being an offshore center for a lot of global MNCs, both in manufacturing and trade, but also with China, where there has been like a reasonable amount of participation and flow of people, which will accompany also the trade and investment flows.
All right, Pranay, anything to add to that?
I think, see, the swing power, so I'm going to talk about it in an abstract way. Akshay has mentioned the details as well, but a swing power is the one which is actually first not aligned with anyone. It is depending, issue-based alliances with different countries is what the approach is. That many small powers also do, right? But what differentiates a swing power from small power is that the side on which the swing power aligns with wins on that particular issue. Okay, so that is what is the definition of swing power. So it should have enough weight by itself that it should swing the decision on that particular issue because of its own weight, right? So if by itself, it might not be able to do that, but if it allies with, say, US, say, China on climate change issue, then what China and India have more in common, that is what the global order on climate change is. Or if India and US ally on, say, the Indian Ocean security issue, then what they wish is what the eventual outcome is. So that is what defines a swing power. And essentially, a swing power should be able to deliver pain or deliver the victory based on its own power, right? So that's really what is required. And a lot of it depends on its own strength. And that's why we assess and we emphasize a lot about the domestic reforms that need to be done. Manoj, I have a related question on that. So there's another document that we'd worked on China's relationship with India in the post-COVID world. So how do you see that panning out?
So my sense of that, as we'd written in the document, was that you're going to see the Chinese, I mean, you're going to see their priorities, their anxieties intensify, but particularly with regard to the Indo-US relationship. And therefore, any sort of balancing that India does or any sort of swinging that India does, which they perceive in sort of American favor, they're going to be far more insecure about it than they anywhere were. So that could sort of increase volatility. I mean, at the moment, we're seeing some tensions along the border. Speculation is that, well, this is because you're going to have this WHO meeting in which India is eventually going to be taking over as on the executive board of the WHO later in this month. And there's this conversation about inviting Taiwan to a WHO grouping conversation. And this is somehow linked to that, where India falls on that decision. I'm not certain if it's entirely linked to that, but the sense is that this is also about where India is moving with regards to pressure on China from the US. There have been a couple of decisions that India has taken in the last weeks. One is on the FDI, which had a role to play in terms of how the Chinese perceived India. And I think some of those things is what amplifies his insecurity. From a structural point of view, I don't think the relationship fundamentally will change. It will remain competitive. There will be strands of cooperation. I think the bit about one of the sort of fundamental failings is that when Wuhan and Chennai in these summits happened, the focus was on people to people, building people to people relationships and building that degree of comfort, increasing leader level engagement. Now, given the pandemic and social distancing and physical distancing, that's really not going to happen. So if that was one track that governments wanted to grow, it's not going to happen. But the other, so then that means that more tricky issues will be on the table. Trade, which has anyway been problematic, will remain problematic. Investments are going to become far more sort of politically sensitive. So it's a difficult, couple of years ahead, and we'll have to navigate that to be able to gain what we can in terms of trade and investment. But also, we're going to see China play a bigger role in the Indian Ocean region. That's going to impinge on our relationship far more. We're already seeing that with, how the Chinese have been, the Chinese ambassador sort of actions in Nepal and all of that. So I think that is the relationship is going to be far more difficult, far more tensed. And your methods that you had used, informal summitry, setting up some mechanisms on the border are going to be really, really strained over the next couple of years. And as the China-US relationship deepens, it's going to become even more tricky for India to manage. So that was a broad sort of sense of the India relationship.
Yeah, I would also add that India's bargaining power vis-a-vis China on the economic front at least improves, because now the BRI becomes even more important for China, but its execution becomes all the more difficult. So in that sense, it would look for profitable markets, big markets, and India is the only one of the few options available to China. So on those kinds of things, China will have to perhaps concede more to India's interests. So that is, I think, one change because of COVID-19.
Yeah, and I guess like you have pointed out in your document, like you guys have, that if India gets a sort of domestic act together with regard to the economy going forward, that will sort of amplify your bargaining power much more. With regard to the Chinese, which sort of gets me to the final section of your document. And Akshay, I want you to get in on this. This is a really interesting section where you highlight three different so-called small bets that India should be making. And the idea is that India, these are, relatively low-cost things that we should be doing, which we can double down when things change. Can you first sort of tell us a little bit about what got you to looking at this? And then we'll talk about each of them.
Sure. So actually, conceptually, if you think about it, in any very uncertain environment like we will see in the world order today, the appropriate strategy is not really to have a single set of things that you do, right, with a kind of deterministic prediction of how the world will shape up, but rather to have a portfolio of initiatives, right? And the portfolio, a good portfolio of initiatives will typically have a set of no-regret moves of the kinds that we've talked about so far, which are a set of domestic economic reforms as well as things that we can do on the military and security front, but also a set of small bets. The reason for these small bets is that in more unlikely scenarios, or at least things which are low probability, it is some of these small bets which, when you double down upon, can actually yield you huge benefits, right? And so in an uncertain environment, you want to have that wider portfolio where, apart from the no-regret moves, you also have a kind of foot in the door with these small bets to be able to double down upon and to be able to kind of exploit an opportunity of what is now maybe considered more unlikely or low probability. But when it does happen, then you can really, because you have actually made a move fairly quickly, can kind of capitalize on that by this doubling down. So that's essentially like the conceptual reason to kind of think of small bets when you have an uncertain world as part of a strategy and a portfolio of initiative.
So you guys talk about three small bets, and I'm not going to go into all three in detail because I'd like people to go and read the document. I'm just going to go into the one which sort of interests me the most, which is cultivate a deeper relationship with Tibetan and Uyghur separatists and with the Taiwan government. I mean, the Taiwan government obviously in the news right now. I want to sort of get a sense of this because India has been very, very cautious with each of these things over the last year and a half or so. So what's the sort of approach that you would recommend?
Yeah, sure. So I think the caution, by the way, is actually quite sensible. Because for the, as I said, this is a small bet, and this is only something that we should double down upon when an currently unlikely scenario actually does manifest, which is if China actually is racked by a lot of internal instability. When that happens, I mean, if and when that happens, then India really, as since China is our primary strategic threat, you want to be in a position then to be able to avoid that internal instability and to cause sufficient internal turmoil in China such that they are racked by such internal instability, and hence the pressure is off India, right? So to be able to plan for that scenario, we have to cultivate a deeper relationship. What is the nature of that deeper relationship? I mean, it could be a variety of things, but for the large part, since this is a small bet, I think it should confine itself to largely covert means of support, because that doesn't rile up China, which will cause short-term costs for us and short-term pain without giving us significant gain at all, right? So I would say that with the Tibetans and with the Uyghurs, it would be things like to be able to support them in a way that they can inflict pain upon Chinese forces. And with the Taiwanese government as well, it would be a range of economic and other cooperation that we can do. I don't necessarily think that doing things like supporting Taiwan's entry into the WHO and other things are things that India should champion, because I think it antagonizes China and doesn't really give us significant benefits in the short run at all, right? So I think that we have to be far more covert and under the radar about this and support these movements. And then when an opportunity comes about, if there is significant internal instability, then to be able to really double down upon that and maybe even supporting what Mr. Eames quite outlandish now, but full-fledged separatist movements in Tibet and in Xinjiang, right? And as well as potential independence for Taiwan. But that's very much into the future. I think right now, I mean, we have to do a version of what we are already doing, which is maintain a kind of covert and relationship with these forces.
So I'm going to sort of ask the last question to just sort of wrap up on all of this with regard to this question that Akshay spoke about with regard to Taiwan. Do the rest of you also agree that India should at the moment be continuing to do what it's doing? Or is there a moment where, there's a low-cost signal that we can say that, look, it's about one meeting and the Taiwanese have attended these meetings in the past also, and even with Xi Jinping being in power. And since if your interest is in combating the pandemic, why not have Taiwan on there? It need not be represented as a country. Would this be something that India should do? Pranay and Anirudh, I just want to get your thoughts before we wrap up.
I think the involvement with Taiwan, like Akshay said, should be on the economic front, because that's the comparative advantage of Taiwan for India. So, for example, Taiwan, more than 50% of contract manufacturing of semiconductor chips happens in Taiwan. In fact, just by one company, right? So such things are there in Taiwan. So India should be, if there is any involvement with Taiwan that we can increase, it should be on the economic side. It gives us a lot more gains. But on the political side, it might make sense probably to, just host a webinar with the Uyghur separatists. Like, what does that cost, right? To signal such things, and it might not even be a government thing, right? It might be, some agency which does this. So there are lots of such things which we can do just to signal the fact that there are other options available to India as well, so that they can become deterrent options going into the future if things get a lot worse.
All right, Anirudh, last word to you.
I broadly agree with what Pranay and Akshay are saying. I think that what India is doing right now is not necessarily sending the right signal to China. China must be coming away from all this by thinking that India is terrified enough of us, India is concerned enough about our various means of coercion that they will not do anything openly. I think that considering that, you know, long-term, China is going to continue to be a rival, it's not going to be the most helpful international partner to have. It makes sense to invest in these relationships long-term. It makes sense to slowly develop means to get under China's skin, potentially to, you know, signal to China that, you know, have means to signal to China that what it's doing is not something that we're comfortable with. I don't necessarily think that getting Taiwan into the World Health Organization right now would really work, considering the sudden resurgence of Wolf Warrior diplomacy from China, and also the fact that India is struggling a little bit economically right now. But definitely long-term, something that we should be doing is trying to figure out ways to get under China's skin.
All right. Okay. Thank you so much, everyone. And thank you so much for listening to us. This is a really, really exhaustive discussion on a document which has lots of interesting ideas in terms of how one can think about Indian prosperity and India's recovery following this pandemic. Thank you, Akshay. Thank you, Pranay. Thank you, Anirudh.
Thank you, Manoj.
Thanks, Anirudh.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is at IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at takshashilainst or our website, takshashila.org.in.